This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
For headlines, the U.S. State Department approved several potential weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan. The early release from prison of a white former U.S. police officer convicted of killing a black teenager provokes an outcry from civil rights activists. And four senior aides to the British Prime Minister resigned from Downing Street in a single day amid growing pressure on Boris Johnson to quit. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. The top story this hour, the United States has approved some potential weapon sales to its allies in West Asia. The U.S. Defense Department says some countries such as Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia are included. According to the Pentagon, the approvals included the possible sale of F-16 fighter jets to Jordan to spare and repair parts for Hawk missiles to the UAE. Riyadh was also okay to buy equipment worth of some $24 million to upgrade its missile defense systems. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have been witnessing increasing retaliatory attacks from Yemen over a war they launched in 2015. The Yemeni army has pledged more attacks inside those countries if they do not stop their deadly airstrikes. The war on Yemen, now in its seventh year, has entered a new phase. The Yemeni army has targeted positions inside the UAE on more than one occasion to drive home the message that the country should stop being a party in this devastating, indiscriminate war. But the U.S. has offered to prop up support for the UAE by deploying an aircraft carrier and fighter jets, a sign of its growing engagement in the conflict.
The U.S. appears to be getting more involved in the war on Yemen. The Pentagon is dispatching a guided missile destroyer and fifth-generation fighter jets to the region amid increasing retaliatory air raids by Yemeni armed forces on vital facilities in the United Arab Emirates. The Pentagon is reportedly reviewing a range of actions to support the UAE. These include providing early warning intelligence, collaborating on air defense, and sending the U.S. Navy guided missile destroyer, the USS Cole, to partner with the UAE Navy.
The fact that the United States is ramping up its war and aggression against the people of Yemen symbolizes that U.S. imperialism is in a state of decay, of chaos and crisis. A rat, a vicious animal, is most fearful and most brutal when it is cornered, when it is left with no other options.
The United States military has also launched interceptor missiles in response to Yemen's retaliatory strikes that targeted the United Arab Emirates. The interventions are seen as a widening U.S. involvement in the war on Yemen. The war was launched by a Saudi-led coalition, which also includes the UAE. The U.S. had officially suspended its offensive in support of Saudi-backed militants. The UAE hosts some 2,000 U.S. soldiers and serves as a crucial base of operations for the deployment of armed drones and F-35 stealth fighters.
The U.S. wants to keep expanding its war machine, and unfortunately, the people of Yemen have been devastated by U.S. Western imperialism through Saudi Arabia as its proxy by constant bombings. Yemen is one of the most impoverished nations, not because of the Yemeni people, but because of the brutal attacks launched on Yemen. Hundreds of thousands of people have died.
Much has been said about the war on Yemen, but one of the lesser known aspects is the UAE's use of mercenary forces in ground battles. At the height of the war, the UAE had a small army of mercenaries numbering around 30,000. The U.S. military trained those forces inside the Emirates. It also made sure that there was a steady flow of arms to keep the war going. The UAE announced in 2019 that it had withdrawn from the war. But as evidenced by later developments, the Persian Gulf state is still heavily enmeshed in the conflict.
The Emirates is Saudi Arabia's main ally in the bloody war on Yemen. The Saudis are trying to change the ruling structure in favor of its former Riyadh-friendly official. The Yemeni forces and the allied fighters from the popular committees have vowed not to lay down their arms until the country's complete liberation from the scourge of the Saudi invasion. Most recently, the joint forces carried out three operations which saw them strike targets deep inside Dubai and Abu Dhabi. The first operation took place on January 17th with five ballistic missiles and a large number of drones. 1 week later, Yemeni forces pounded the Al Dhafra airbase along with important targets in Dubai. They also hit a number of military camps in Sharura town of Saudi Arabia's Najran and strategic sites in the kingdom's Jizan and Asir regions. In the third operation on January 31st, Yemen's Zulfiqar ballistic missiles and Samad 3 drones struck targets in Abu Dhabi and Dubai.
Apart from the United States and the United Kingdom, the usual culprits when it comes to imperialism and war, one of the other actors, bad actors, in this horrible, atrocious war that has been taking place is the occupying settler state of Israel, an apartheid state based on the exploitation and colonization of Palestinian people. Israel, even though Israel doesn't necessarily have boots on the ground, so to speak, in Yemen, it's still financing the technology, the weapons, of the chaos that's being ensued in Yemen through its financial schemes, through its banking institutions, its geopolitical interests as well.
The UAE has helped Israel establish strategic bases in the Yemeni island of Socotra. The bases will be used to collect information from across the Gulf of Aden, including Bab al-Mandeb and south of Yemen, which is under the control of forces backed by the UAE.
What we're seeing is that Israel has been playing a behind-the-scenes role this whole time, bankrolling the war on Yemen, bankrolling the genocide of the Yemeni people. And interestingly enough, their secretive role, their shadowy role in this war is now being revealed. The curtain is being pulled on Zionism, and it stands revealed for the world to see just how bloody it is.
Socotra has been a source of tension between the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which have been vying for control of the resource-rich island. UAE-backed separatists of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, or the STC, took control of Socotra in June 2020 in a move described as a full-fledged coup.
Activists in the U.S. city of Chicago called for justice after a white former police officer convicted of murdering a black teenager in 2014 was released early from prison. Listen.
We're demanding a full-scale investigation and prosecution. Now, we also made this demand in 2016, so we're asking the Department of Justice to give us a status on it. We want to go forward with this. Under federal statutes, Title 18, Section 242, he can be indicted for murder, tried and prosecuted. And that's exactly what we want. That's exactly what we want.
Justice is on trial now. That's what Chicago's Catholic priest father said at a rally against the early release of ex-cop Jason Van Dyke. He was freed after 39 months in prison instead of serving an 81-month sentence. Chicago authorities say the ex-cop showed good behavior while in detention. Van Dyke murdered Laquan McDonald, 17 years old, in October 2014, but he was charged more than a year later following public pressure. That happened after a released dashcam video showed Van Dyke shooting McDonald 16 times within seconds as the teenager was walking away. African Americans have long been subjected to brutality by white police officers, with the majority of cases going unpunished. British Premier Boris Johnson faces a fresh crisis as four of his closest aides quit amid growing calls for him to resign. Johnson's chief of staff, his principal private secretary, his director of communications, and his head of policy all resigned, resulting in a tumultuous day for his government. Three of the officials were directly linked to the Downing Street parties held during COVID-19 lockdown. Johnson has been slammed for the gatherings publicly known as the Partygate scandal. The premier has also been condemned for accusing Labour Party leader Keir Starmer of failing to prosecute a sex offender in the past. The comments prompted the resignation of Johnson's head of policy, and it provoked criticism from his finance minister. Political commentator Ian Williams says that resignations tendered by some of the government's aides in the UK may be a diversionary tactic to preserve Boris Johnson's premiership. Stick listen.
People aren't entirely sure whether these recent resignations are actually resignations, or whether it's a case of Johnson throwing them overboard to distract the wolves and preserve himself. At least one of them was an issue of principle. The press attaché who resigned over Johnson's insistence that it was Starmer's fault that the former TV star and accused paedophile Jimmy Savile was there. What Johnson's brought attention to, it shows his ineptitude, is that Jimmy Savile, the person he accused Starmer of protecting, was in fact the darling of Margaret Thatcher. He attended Number 10. He was spoke in her favour. He was forever by her side on public appearances. So it's allowed people to sort of rake over the coals and show the party's antecedents with their unsavoury characters, of which there are many.
Iran had been under the rule of monarchical dynasties for 2,500 years. But 43 years ago, a popular uprising changed all that and opened a new chapter in the country's history. In this report, we've taken a closer look at the series of events that culminated in the Islamic Revolution of 1979 and the leader who inspired and spearheaded that movement.
For centuries, Iran was governed by monarchies and autocratic rulers, and the last dynasty to rule was founded by Reza Shah Pahlavi in 1925. During his reign that lasted for 16 years, Reza Shah replaced Islamic laws with Western ones as part of reforms that drew public discontent. In 1941, he was forced to abdicate the throne to his son, Mohammad Reza. The new Shah maintained a close relationship with the U.S. His government was known for its autocracy and focus on westernization, as well as a disregard for religious and democratic measures in Iran's constitution. Mohammad Reza Shah was largely criticized for political corruption and the oppression committed by his secret police, known as Savak. He established the service with help from Israel and the CIA, its main aim to monitor opponents and repress dissent. Savak's practice of torture and executions of the regime's opponents made it the most notorious and feared institution in Iran prior to the Islamic Revolution. In 1963, the Shah launched a series of reforms known as the White Revolution. Although the reforms brought some progress to Iran, they were met with a strong criticism from the public. The opposition to Shah and his White Revolution was spearheaded by Ayatollah Khomeini, a prominent religious figure who believed the Shah had embarked on a path toward the destruction of Islam. In June of that year, Imam Khomeini delivered his famous sermon at Fazia Seminary, where he strongly criticized the Shah's policies. After that speech, he was arrested, and that sparked 3 days of mass rallies nationwide, with his supporters saying 15,000 people were killed by police. After spending 8 months under house arrest, Imam Khomeini was released. But he remained a strong and outspoken critic of the Shah regime for its policies, including its close cooperation with Israel. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile for another 15 years. But popular support for him grew even further during his absence. Opposition to the Pahlavi regime continued to spread, with Iranians outraged at the high inflation rate, a widening gap between rich and poor, and the repression of freedom of speech. Anger was also high at the royal family benefiting the most from the country's oil revenues at a time when thousands of poor people were suffering under austerity measures to curb the inflation. Popular rage was further ignited by the death of Imam Khomeini's son Mustafa at the hands of Savak. His death on October 23, 1977, set off a chain of mass demonstrations that grew in the months ahead and turned into a campaign of civil resistance. To appease the protesters, the Shah regime launched reforms and pledged to do more. However, none of those measures were welcome, with the protesters remaining steadfast as insisting that the monarchy must be overthrown and that Imam Khomeini should return home. The anti-Shah demonstrations started growing in their millions nationwide, despite a heavy-handed crackdown by the military. On January 16, 1979, the Shah and his family finally left Iran for Egypt. And nearly 2 weeks later, on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned to Tehran with a promise to form a government that would have popular support. On February the 11th, the Pahlavi regime was overthrown and the Islamic Revolution emerged victorious. And on April the 1st, Iran became an Islamic Republic in a referendum voted for by more than 98% of the electorate. The period from February the 1st to 11th is known as Dahe Fajr, or the 10-day dawn in Iran. Every year, Iranians celebrate the Islamic Revolution that brought an end to 2,500 years of monarchical rule in their country.
And that's your world news for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
New documentary sheds fresh light on the 1948 killings, decades after a master's student was embroiled in controversy for exposing it, says Ilan Papp, writer, in an article titled, "The Zionist Regime Can No Longer Bury the Tantura Massacre." Stay tuned for more. The writer of the article says, "In late 1990s, I was teaching at the University of Haifa. One of my most popular manuals was the Nakba, which, when pressure from the university was too much to bear, had to be reframed as the history and historiography of 1948. The main assignment asked the students to research what occurred in 1948 in the places where they lived or were born. There was one extraordinary student, older than me, the ultimate kibbutznik, who wore shorts even on the coldest days of the year and a huge Stalin-esque mustache. He responded eagerly to the assignment and found out that Kibbutz Magal, where he lived, was founded on the ruins of the village of Zeta. Naively, he tried to invite the survivors of 1948 Nakba to visit and talk to the settlers who overtook their village, but he was scorned and castigated by his fellow kibbutznik. The student Teddy Katz wished to continue exploring 1948 for his master's thesis, and I suggested writing a microhistory of villages affected by the Nakba. He chose five of them south of Haifa and on the Mediterranean coast. I declined to be his supervisor as I was already at odds with the university over how to teach and research the history of Palestine. So he chose two mainstream supervisors. The thesis received an exceptionally high grade, and his fourth chapter revealed through documents and interviews with troops and Palestinians that in May 1948, the Zionist regime army perpetrated a massacre in the village of Tantura, south of Haifa, a war crime that escaped most, but not all, of the known histories of the Nakba up to that time. There were 60 hours of interviews about Tantura and documents showing that around 200 villages were either shot in cold blood or killed by angry Zionist troops who rampaged through the village in response to the death of around 8 of their fellow troops. The executions were graphically described by Jewish and Palestinian eyewitnesses and alluded to in the documents, which also described mass graves dug near a graveyard where today there is a parking lot for kibbutz built on the ruins of Tantura. Katz was not obliged to tape his interviews, but he shared them with whoever wanted to listen, including, the writer says, I myself, and I still have copies of all 60 hours. The writer of the article says, the very same troops who confessed to committing the massacre were horrified to learn that a journalist found Katz's thesis interesting and published his findings in Daily Ma'ariv. Under pressure from other veterans and with the help of a lawyer closely connected to the university, they went to court and denied the evidence they gave, suing Katz for libel. Katz was asked by university authorities to hand over his tapes, which was his first mistake. He was not obliged to do so. On the basis of the tapes and some insignificant discrepancies between the interviews and their transcription in the thesis, there were six such cases out of hundreds of codes. The veterans went to the court and the university declared its refusal to defend Katz's excellent thesis. Then a Greek tragedy unfolded. Under pressure from his family and after a harrowing experience during the first day in court, Katz was convinced to write a Stalinist confession, a willful fabrication of the truth about Tantura. He regretted it a few hours later, but it was too late, and the next stages were unavoidable. The court forced him to pay the expenses of the prosecution, and he became a pariah in his own kibbutz. The university demanded a new thesis, which he wrote, adding even more solid proof about the massacre, and although he passed, he received a lower grade, and his thesis was removed from the library. Not surprisingly, amid all the stress, he suffered two strokes, and today, this one energetic person is in a wheelchair. The writer of the article added, this all occurred in early 2000s, and I did all I could to encourage the university to change its attitude, a campaign that eventually cost me my job, even though I was a tenured lecturer. I also published in Hebrew an article stating that there was a massacre in the village, but no one dared take me to court. At the time, the Zionist regime media and the academic establishment at best ridiculed Katz and me. At worst, they called us traitors. The campaign of delegitimation of my work by leading Israeli historians continues to this day. Students are dissuaded from using my works. You can hardly find them in libraries, and nasty reviews occasionally make their way into local papers, although they are not accepted by the international community. Now, film director Alan Schwartz was finally able to catch up to the Jewish protagonist in the Greek tragedy. Some of them confessed on camera that Katz told the truth and recorded faithfully their version of events in 1948. With the help of cutting-edge technology, Schwartz was able to uncover the mass graves and prodded the judge who was sitting in the original trial to admit she had never listened to the tapes. After listening to one in the film, she acknowledged the verdict could have been very different. In all this, we should not forget what is important. The massacre was part of an overall crime against humanity that the Zionist regime committed in 1948 and continues to perpetrate to this very day, a crime that is still widely denied. Films or dissertations by conscientious Jews are not enough to rectify this crime. The only relevant closure for this ongoing criminality is the decolonization of all of historical Palestine and the full implementation of the right of return. In a free and domestic Palestine, a memorial in Tantura could be a meaningful reminder of the past. But when it only appears on the pages of Zionist papers such as Haaretz, it adds insult to injury without a more concrete rectification of past evils.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
Iran before the Islamic Revolution is not similar to Iran after it. This revolution, whose foundations were based on faith, religious piety, and theoretical and practical gratitude, was not led by emotion, recklessness, and dispersed sentiments. Rather, these sentiments were directed to be a stream that flows into the practical teachings of the revolution of morals, ethics, sincerity, altruism, humanity, trust, and faith. This terminology that many revolutions in the world never knew, which led to its disappearance on the level of impact as the years progressed, is the terminology itself which granted the Islamic Revolution the status of justice, free popular will, independence, and brotherhood. Simply because it was never smeared with the first bullet even against those who harbored hostility towards Iran since the birth of its Islamic Revolution. This revolution was adorned with blood, not stained. Imam Khomeini's revolution was preserved with the blood of the martyrs, so its children held their heads high with pride, as it had never been based on violence and the initiation of wars. This revolution was defended by the public and the common people. the people of the beautiful south, Khuzestan, Sistan, and Balochistan, Khurasan, and all the regions of the south in particular, and the Iranian homeland in general. Those who took up arms in defense of the sovereignty of the land, old and young, men and women marched in a human stream to the site of the wound of their homeland. Some of them died and some of them were detained, so that the motherland remains, that justice remains, and that the peoples return to being united on the trait of brotherhood. It is a revolution that conjoined with another revolution, uprising and resistance of the people of Al-Quds. This formed the incubator and the arm to fight the cancerous entity that afflicted the body of beloved Palestine, the first of the two Qiblas. Iran's leader today, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, affirms the recommendations of the second phase of the revolution and simulates the fourth generation with the need to know the past in order to build the future. A future that began decades ago with growth and prosperity in terms of science, technology, art, economy, community, and culture. A resilient bond resulted from this blessed revolution between the Republic and the people, and it continued as per a deep-rooted oath of freedom, national pride, combating corruption, and raising the banners of science, economy, and morals. 43 years later, salute to every martyr who died defending the homeland. Salute to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, whom with his martyrdom drew a line illustrating the course of the second phase of the revolution. Salute to the families of the martyrs. Salute to the axis of resistance on this occasion, this tributary that nourishes the revolution and still gets nourished by it. Salute to the free people of the world who were inspired by the Imam Khomeini revolution and rejected the policies of globalization and westernization. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Three years have passed, yet the features of the Islamic revolution are still emerging. Between every will for evil and every hand of tyranny, Imam Ruhullah Khomeini's revolution shines, sometimes in its Husseini form, other times in its Soleimani form, to prove that the steps that were drawn along the path of belief and faith are not shaken by the beating drums of injustice and arrogance. Today, the victory of 1979 is in brighter color. Today, Iran not only stands firm in a position of glorification, contented with what the hands of its martyrs, scholars, and leaders have achieved, but it stands strong behind its leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who called upon his nation and the broader Islamic nation to take the second step towards victory. 43 years later, the Iranian nation embraces for new possibilities, starting with scientific and technical progress to comprehensive human development at all levels, rewriting their future on the pages of the Islamic revolution. To discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Hamid Reza, Tehran's Deputy Mayor of International Affairs. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Reza. Now, this was a moment that changed the face of history. I mean, the whole world remembers when Imam Ruhullah Khomeini was stepping down from the Boeing 747 plane, which landed after 14 years in exile in the French town of Louvain-le-Château. That was 43 years ago. How has the Islamic revolution affected the growth of the Iranian nation as a whole, Mr. Reza?
By changing Iran into a real sovereign country. Well, actually, first of all, thank you very much for having me. But in response to your question, actually, the main thing that the Islamic revolution and Imam Khomeini did to this country was handing it into a real country which is sovereign. Before that, Iran was a puppet regime, a client state to the best description, the best scenario, we can say, was a client state to the United States. And it was a battleground for the Cold War between the United States and the Soviets, or before that, between the British and the Russians. And it has always been a ground for other Westerners to fight for their own interests in Iran and other countries in the region, just like we are now witnessing in some of the countries in the region, of course. So what we had before the revolution, for example, five decades ago, was a puppet regime without any control over the country, without any control over the resources, and a country in which people were actually divided into the elite ruling class, which was connected to the royal family, and the rest of the nation who were suffering from different poverty, were from lack of resources and anything. So that was the difference, the huge gap actually between the two levels, the royals, the elites, and the rest of the nation. But after the revolution, it changed, and Iran tried to indigenize people as a power and to find its power in its nation, actually, by having a connection between the ruling government and the nation. Actually, the power came from the people themselves.
And so this is very interesting to me, Dr. Reza, because after this unfair imbalance that went on for so long in favor of America, which basically always seeks to subjugate the world to its own ideology, to its dollar system, to its goods and interests and services by plundering Iran's wealth, as you said, giving itself the right to punish whomever it wants, exporting its so-called democratic values by force, and imposing its arrogance and guardianship on regimes and on peoples. Today we can see to what extent the Islamic Republic of Iran has actually changed, flipped that equation. But as a young Iranian yourself, how did the revolution support you after 43 years and your family, especially under severe unilateral punitive measures imposed by the US regime?
You know, the main point is maybe at the very surface, if you can look at the situation in Iran after four decades of tough sanctions. I remember at least four American presidents who said that they are imposing most crippling sanctions on Iranian nation, and Iran is still standing on its feet, and it is standing against and is challenging actually the sanctions regime of the United States. So that is the point, that the Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution has made it possible for its nation to look for a bright future. It is moving toward that. We don't say that we have reached that, but that place, but we are on the right track to reach that position. That is the issue, that we are now one of the top countries in many important areas, like for example infrastructure, like high tech, like for example basic sciences, and like nano and such modern sciences, we can say, and in defense capabilities. First of all, Iran has provided security for its people, and it's trying to make everything domestic and indigenous in order not to be depending on the other countries, not to be depending on the American dollars or on the Western supports and such things. So this sovereignty is the first, and this sovereignty brings actually the real opportunity for the people to be able to work for the future, to be able to try to, let's say for example, invest in the future, in the sciences, in the studies, in the startups and such things that are happening right now. They know that there is a real country that they can work and fight for.
Well, Dr. Reza, you are telling us about the developments. You explained the development path of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its scientific, technological, cultural, and civilizational integration. It is immersed in its progressing path, as you explained. But the West portrays the Islamic Republic as the complete opposite of what you just said. Why are they afraid to admit their failure and pursue maybe a different approach with the Islamic Republic?
Because at the time that the Islamic Revolution happened, the world was stuck in the bipolar world, and the fight between the East and the West, the Eastern bloc of the Soviets and the Western bloc led by the Americans, and the Islamic Revolution actually introduced a new third narrative to say that neither East nor West, we are actually offering a new form of government based on the Islamic teaching. And if you admit that this system is working, then you should admit that the liberal democracy and the liberal capitalism in the West has failed. The communism failed long ago, and the only remaining model in the West is the liberal capitalism. And by admitting that the Islamic Republic has lonely fought against all those punitive measures, all those sanctions, all those inhuman, actually, pressures that they have put on Iran, you should admit that it has been successful. You should admit that the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic form of government is something that is truly serving the people, and it means that the others have failed. So if you admit that the Iran has fought against the terrorism and has removed the Daesh, ISIS in the Syria and Iraq and the region, or has fought against the terrorism in the whole West Asia, then you should admit that the Americans have done nothing, and they have actually supported the terrorists in this region. So they simply have put logics aside, and they are thinking just adhering to their own interests, and because of their own interests, they are unable to, or let's say they avoid it, to admit that they have failed and the Islamic Republic has been successful in moving forward with the agenda it has. It is moving slowly, but it is moving forward.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hamid Reza, Tehran's Deputy Mayor for International Affairs, for joining us and telling us how it feels from inside the Islamic Republic of Iran as a youth and member of the community of the Islamic Republic. Thank you very much, and here's to more than 50-plus years of success to come to the Iranian nation. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will speak how this light that came with Imam Khomeini's revolution shined all over the world.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Today, the Iranian Islamic Revolution completes its 43rd year, bringing with it tools acquired over decades that qualify it for survival, for continuity and progress in the process of facing both external challenges and internal developments. This revolution represents a civilized movement and a cultural renaissance that had the ingredients to influence global developments. We see that it was able, despite the attempts to isolate it, to besiege it, and to actually thwart all these conspiracies and to resist trends that the strongest of regimes were not able to withstand. Modern history attests that what Iran has faced and is still facing to this day, because of economic and commercial warfare imposed by the major colonial powers, and a military war, by the way, that drained its capabilities for more than 8 years, which no regime faced in modern history. Thanks to the faith of its people, the unity of its ranks, the wisdom of the founder Imam Khomeini and the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Iran has overcome all these ordeals, and it's still facing and defying all these crises and conspiracies with insight. From Iran to the free people of the world, in this following report. Today, the Islamic Revolution in Iran completes its 43rd year, bringing with it tools that it acquired over decades, which qualify it for survival, continuity, and progress in the process of facing external challenges and internal developments in all their forms. This revolution represents a civilized movement and a cultural renaissance that has the ingredients to influence global developments and events. We see that it was able, despite the attempts to isolate, limit, and besiege it since its eruption, to thwart all these conspiracies and schemes and to resist trends that the strongest regimes could not withstand. Modern history attests that what the Islamic face of this revolution has encountered and is still facing to this day of an economic and commercial war imposed on it by Western regimes. Thanks to its faith, the unity of its ranks, and the wisdom of its founder Imam Khomeini and its leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, Iran has overcome all these ordeals and is still facing and defying all these crises and conspiracies with steadfastness and insight. However, the Islamic Republic not only united and resisted and was not only preoccupied with facing challenges, but also continued its development path and its scientific, technological, cultural, and civilizational integration. The moment of the revolution was like a volcanic eruption that changed the features of the country and the history of the region. It is no longer possible to go back, but rather looking forward is a major goal for the revolution's subsequent phases in its progressing path.
The revolution today is not a static revolution whose spring has passed, entering a dull fall as per the cases of several historic revolutions. Rather, it is a renewed revolution in its pulse, because the renewal of goals and the constant setting of scientific plans makes it a steadfast historical revolution. That is the case in Iran, because the goal of Imam Khomeini's revolution was not merely to change the regime, the president, the state, and the throne, but rather the goal was reform, righteousness, and progress of the nation. You see, when the human goal is based on the eternal Islamic and heavenly principles, then this approach and this path cannot end. So it is a revolution that keeps pace with modernity in its local tools that it acquired from its knowledge system. The experience of the Islamic Revolution on its 43rd anniversary can only be understood through an objective, deconstructive, analytical approach in isolation from hostile attitudes and opposing ideologies in order to find out its true features, its major objectives, and its humanitarian goal that concerns all free peoples of the world. Now to discuss this issue with us from Athens is Lamprini Poma, journalist at the Press Project and MC at Radio Venceremos. Thank you very much for being with us, dearest Lamprini. Now, the world after the Islamic Revolution in Iran is not the same as before it. The awakening that came after a set of setbacks that shook the popular resolve from the fall of the Mossadegh government in Tehran at the hands of the American and British intelligence to the deadlock of the National Project after the departure of Jamal Abdel Nasser and the betrayal of Sadat is nothing but an embodiment of the anger of the peoples of this Arab and Islamic region. In what ways, Lamprini, do you think that the Islamic Revolution resonate to the peoples of the global south of our planet, who were eager to profess their identity, to restore their rights and dignity, and to grasp their role in the movement of history?
Thank you for having me. The Iranian revolution is a rupture in history in more ways than other revolutions, because it brings in the forefront not only the needs of the people, especially the people who survived the tyranny and brutality of colonialism. We must always remember that many peoples didn't survive, but also brought religion in the equation as the main expression of the traditions of the people, the civilization of the people, in our case the Iranian people. Religion was part of the resistance in the fight against oppression and colonialism in Latin America and in Palestine, but in Iran it was the main power. In a world where the two superpowers at the time, USA and USSR, thought it was forever dead and gone, it was a proof that you can win with God on your side, really, especially a God of martyrdom and sacrifice. And martyrdom and sacrifice are the secret weapons of all the popular fights in all the global south. Iranian revolution embodies that in every possible way. The Iranian revolution happened in a time when most anti-colonial movements and anti-establishment movements seemed to win, and when the exploitation of the oppressed was starting to get new forms, when neo-colonialism was starting to emerge as the answer to all the fight and the blood that we shed as people for our freedom and dignity, back from the West and the dominant East at the time. The depth of the beauty of that revolution, the fear it spread to the colonial powers and the power it gave to all of us, is shown in the war that followed right away, the Iran-Iraq war, and how the Iranian people managed, by shedding their blood again, as usual, to win that fight too. And I dare to say every fight after that one. Mm-hmm. That by itself makes it even today an inspiration for every people who continues to fight in the war.
Well, Lamprini, talking about the lively pulse of the revolution necessitates that we address internal developments that do not know any stagnation, especially in Iran, because the democratic movement is stable at every level, as we have witnessed over the past decades, and popular participation is the title of state building. This is what the leaders always speak about, popular participation with all its involvement of women that is rarely seen even in the largest democratic countries of this world. Now, why are the surrounding countries, the neighboring countries to Iran, afraid of such a model? Why not just embrace something similar instead of grasping to the old ways of tyranny and suppression?
Allow me to add two things. Iran continued to progress not only socially, economically, but also scientifically, while leaving other sanctions in that field too. Same happened with the Iranian military power. There is a little of the Cuban experience there. I think revolution teach each other, and that's a good thing. Second, the Iranian people are a lively and proud people that is not afraid to express their opinion or take the streets if needed. They are demonstrating and protesting when they see it fit, because they are people of the revolution, and they want their states to be more revolutionary, be better, fight the ills of all states that will surface with time. Now, in the countries where we didn't succeed to overthrow colonialism and post-colonialism, we live under the spell of the media and the elites. Thus, the old ways of colonialism are easy. They sound modern. It is to accept that the West is the model we shall all follow. Elites reason in the post-colonial bubble of the superiority of the Western white men and of history as something that starts when they are born. Elites that do not know what a real civilization tastes like. That is why the revolution is still something that they cannot comprehend, because it showed that time and history are totally different for the people, especially the oppressed, that they have their way to remember, to weave it in grassroots level, let's say, to weave there their own truth, their own civilization, in a way that it will survive every blow, and that if you don't respect the identity of the people will revolt sooner or later. And they will win sooner or later their independence. Mm-hmm. We tend to forget that independence means respecting the civilization of the people and the right to change their country themselves too. Independence is not a state thing, it is a people thing. Mm-hmm. Even modernization of the nations must be done with respect to the people's identity and tradition at a given time to mature.
Well, despite the arrogance of the West that we keep hearing against this revolution, the hostile invasion against this revolution from all sides and in all dimensions, the ideological and faith background of this revolution makes it a march that knows really no obstacles, because it's based on certain religious teachings that say there will always be a way to overcome hardships. What was the main drive that kept this wave going, Lamprini, for 43 years of stepping into light, denouncing darkness and submission to either the West or the East?
It is the unity that was brought to the Iranian society by those same words and measures which were made to break it. The Persians, the Iranians, are an ancient historic people with great knowledge of their identity and their history. Wars and sanctions are fuel to the generator of the revolution, are themselves generators of resistance. Furthermore, the ones governing today are the revolution generation and the first generation after that. In the case of the Iranian revolution, the West reacts generally stupidly and vindictively, I think. They cannot understand the revolution and they believe they know everything. And they are still afraid of the Iranian people. They know where the power stands there. And they have seen their embassy turned into a museum of arrogance. It's a place that I loved when I visited now, after the revolution. Mm-hmm. The West does not believe that they can be friends with the revolutionary people, the people with identity. Thus, they are not really friendly in their approach towards Iran. There never will be such an approach as long as the revolutionary spirit survives, which is something we all wish. And it has nothing to do with rights and religion, I should say that. You just have to see how friendly their approach is to Saudi Arabia to mm-hmm. understand that it's not that the case is not that. It has to do with the fear of barbaric raw power when opposite to a fruitful civilization with deep roots and a revolutionary tradition.
Well, it's so refreshing to hear such thoughts coming out from a lady who is, according to the map, a Western lady, but at heart is definitely from the Global South. I want to thank you very much from Athens, Ms. Lamprini Thoma, journalist at the Press Project and MC at Radio Venceremos. I advise people to listen to her, to read her writings. It's absolutely refreshing. Thanks a million for being with us, Lamprini, and thanks a million. I'll see you next week.
In the limelight.
Recently, the Ontario provincial government announced a formal partnership with two Canadian advocacy groups, both of which are strong supporters of the Zionist regime. According to the announcement, the government is awarding the groups approximately $300,000. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Paul Salvatore Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "The Ontario Government Should Reconsider Engaging with Pro-Israeli Regime Groups." Stay tuned for more. Recently, the Ontario provincial government announced a formal partnership with two Canadian advocacy groups, Friends of Simon and Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, both of which are strong supporters of the Zionist regime. According to the announcement, the government is awarding the groups approximately $300,000, divided as follows: $148,000 to the Friends of Simon Wiesenthal Center for studies to create a collection of bilingual classroom resources and programming that will introduce students to the topic of anti-Semitism and ways to recognize and address anti-Semitism. $150,000 to the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs to develop bilingual classroom resources targeted at students in grades 5 to 8 on the dangers of anti-Semitism. While on the surface, the partnership is thinkable, both groups involved are proactive in vilifying Palestinian voices that speak out against the illegal occupation of Palestine, often smearing those who do as anti-Semitic. But one needs to ask, what is hateful about protesting what Michael Link, Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories Occupied Since 1967, observes? Quote, "More than 680,000 settlers living in segregated and privileged settlements amid 5 million stateless